Well, thank you, Mr. Klein, and welcome everybody. And thank you to Mr. Pischke for that first message. That was a very interesting message on Job. It's quite a book, and you brought that out to us. You triggered a couple other memories, too, about Pentecost being on a Monday. And I can remember those days when the church would make a three-day weekend out of it. We'd have a picnic or some kind of social on the Sunday in between there. That was quite a long time ago. You also talked about wisdom in years. And my years keep going up, but I keep hoping for this growth spurt in wisdom because it's not catching up, not keeping up with the years, it seems. Well, anyway, this afternoon I want to talk about weddings, and in particular, the wedding between the church and Christ. There are scriptures that talk about the church as becoming the bride of Christ. For example, in Ephesians 5, 25 through 26, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. In verse 27, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. And in verse 31 of Ephesians 25, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. So he talks about Christ and the church being as husband and wife. And I'll also mention Revelation 19:7 that says, let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready. And those are all just background showing about this wedding that is to come. So there is going to be a wedding. And when that time comes, we, as members of God's church, are going to be taking part in it. Now, the Bible has several mentions about weddings. There are several parables that talk about weddings. We're familiar with each of them, taken one at a time. I don't know if any of you have ever put them together, but they convey a message if you look at all of them together. And looking at those examples may give us a clue of what lies ahead and how we make ourselves ready. So the title of this message is Preparing for the Wedding. Preparing for the Wedding. We'll take a look at some of the steps involved in that preparation. So step one, there are going to be five steps that I'll mention. Step one is we need to accept the invitation. Let's take a look at the parable of the wedding feast. This is in Matthew 22. Matthew 22, if you'd like to turn there. And it's in verses 1 through 14. Now, just prior to this, in the previous chapter, Christ had given the parable about the landowner who had leased his vineyard to vine dressers. But when he sent his servants to collect the fruit, the vine dressers killed the servants and killed the next group of servants that went out, and finally killed the landowner's son. And this wedding parable is connected to that. It follows it. In Matthew 21:45, when the chief priests and the Pharisees heard the prophet or heard his parables, they perceived that he was speaking of them. But when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitudes, because they took him for a prophet. Now they didn't actually lay hands on Christ, but Christ knew their thoughts and knew what they were thinking. And so he goes on and talks about the parable of this wedding feast or marriage feast. Matthew 22, starting in verse 1, and Jesus answered and spoke to them again by parables and said, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son and sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding. So you can picture what's happened prior to this point. The invitations had gone out, and the king had made preparations for this marriage, so he was expecting all these people to show up. But when the time came, the people who had been invited needed to make a choice of whether they were going to accept the invitation or not, whether they were going to be there. And we've all been invited to many weddings, and some we eagerly look forward to and are eager to accept, and we respond right away and we show up. We're just glad to be there. There may be some that we attend kind of out of obligation. Well, this person was my father's best friend's nephew or something like that, where we don't really know the people, but we kind of feel obligated to be there. And there are some that we may not be able to attend, whether we want to or not, and others we just decline. We don't show up. We maybe don't even respond, although I would hope we would say we're not coming. But the invitees to this wedding were in the latter group. They just didn't show up. Picking up where I left off, this being the end of verse 3, he sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding, and they were not willing to come. Again, he sent out other servants saying, tell those who were invited, see, I've prepared my dinner. My oxen and fatted cattle are all killed and all things are ready. Come to the wedding. This king had made great preparations for this. He'd prepared a lot of food. He was preparing for a lot of people to be there. Verse 5, but they made light of it and went on their ways. One to his own farm, another to his business. So when they refused the invitation by the first servants, they were given another chance, and another group of servants was sent out. The people who were invited made light of it. We can imagine some of the excuses they might have given. Well, I'm too busy right now. Or I changed my mind. I was going to come, but I just can't do it now. Or I've already made other plans. I can't make it. Or maybe my friends weren't invited, so I'm just going to stay here with my friends instead. Or maybe I wasn't expecting it to be so soon. And we can imagine other excuses they would come up with. The truth was, this wedding just wasn't important to them. And then it got even worse than that in verse 6. Now, some of the people, when they were asked to come to the wedding, we read that they made light of it, they made excuses. But in verse 6, and the rest seized his servants, treated them spitefully, and killed them. But when the king heard about it, he was furious, and he sent out his armies, destroyed those murderers, and burned up their city. Then he said to his servants, the wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Those who were invited had affronted the king and his son. They had refused the invitation, and because of that, they were no longer worthy to come to the wedding. So it goes on in verse 9, therefore go into the highways, and as many as you find, invite to the wedding. So those servants went out into the highways and gathered together all whom they found, both bad and good. And the wedding hall was filled with guests. So when we look at the interpretation of this parable, the invitation went out to Gentiles, and many of them came. But then something kind of curious happens in verse 11. But when the king came in to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. So he said to him, friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment? And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot, take him away, and cast him into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen. Now, what about this wedding garment he talked about? It says they invited bad and good people who had just been brought in off the streets. So how could they be expected to come in proper wedding attire? There's a book, Hard Sayings of the Bible, that I looked this up in. It's by Kaiser and several other authors or editors. He says, on the one hand, this may have been a separate parable, the part about the wedding garment. But he goes on to say, well, what's the point of mentioning it unless it's part of this parable itself? And he goes on in there to say that clothes are often used in the Bible as a symbol of personal character. And it's possibly implied that some might think themselves entitled to be counted among the children of the kingdom or the followers of Jesus whose character was out of keeping with such a profession. So in other words, there were people there who were there, and they thought maybe they should be there, but they actually didn't have the right character that God is looking for, and that's why they were cast out. So people had been invited to the wedding when the time came, and they were expected to come. They took it lightly. They made various excuses, and some even seized and killed the servants sent out to call them. The invitations then went out to others who accepted the invitation. And those others, that's us. We've been invited, and we have accepted the invitation. Now that's the first step. We've done it. But we need to be aware that some of those who initially accepted were later found to be unworthy. And we've seen that over the years, too. So that's step one, is to accept the invitation. A step two is being ready when the time comes. We've been invited, we've accepted the invitation, but we don't know when the actual wedding will take place. It's as if we've received a hold-the-date invitation, but we haven't been told what date to hold yet. Just that we'll be given more information as the time draws near, and at some point, that time will arrive. And when it does arrive, it may seem to happen suddenly when we're not expecting it. Let's look at the next step. And this is illustrated by the parable of the 10 virgins. This is in Matthew 25. Matthew 25, the first 13 verses. Starting in verse 1, then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them, but the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. Now this isn't distinguishing between good and bad people. According to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, he says the duty of these attendants, the virgin attendants on the bride, was to go forth at night with lamps and be ready on the appearance of the bridegroom to conduct the bride to his house and go with him to the marriage. And the same commentary says that this parable can warn us how large a portion of those who, up to the last, so nearly resemble those that loves Christ's appearing will be disowned by him when the time comes or when he comes. Now, it in no way implies necessarily that half of the people will be turned away or anything like that, but just that some will. In verse 6, it goes on, and at midnight a cry was heard, behold, the bridegroom is coming, go out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, no, lest there should not be enough for us and you, but go rather to those who sell and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. Now those who had been living according to God's law had God's Spirit, symbolized by the lamps and the oil in the lamps. Up until that point, their lamps may all have been burning brightly and appeared to be indistinguishable from one another, or perhaps they were all off at that point and you couldn't tell one from another. But only when they turned their lamps on and the ones who weren't ready, the oil ran out and their lamps went out, is when you could tell the difference between them. And by telling the unwise to go out and buy more oil, they aren't suggesting that God's Spirit can be purchased, but they're only saying that there is a legitimate way to get it, and we need to do that, have to do that ahead of time. In verse 11, afterward, the other virgins also came also saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." So we need to be spiritually ready for the wedding. That's the second step, being ready when the time comes. But once we get there, once we get to the wedding, we're about to enter wherever the wedding is going to be held, whether it's to a banquet or to the ceremony, we need to behave appropriately, as described in the parable that's referred to as the parable of the unambitious guest. This parable is found in Luke 14. Verses 7 through 14. So verse 7 of Luke 14. So he told a parable to those who were invited, when he noted how they chose the best places, saying to them, "When you are invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him come and say to you, 'Give place to this man.' And then you begin with shame to take the lowest place." In a commentary on Luke by T.C. Butler, he talks about the places of honor at the table. And he says that at banquets and dinners, distinguished persons were given seats or places of honor. A group of three cushions or couches were used for reclining. The chief seats were the first reclining places at the table. And then he's quoting someone else saying, A.T. Robertson notes, "On a couch holding three, the middle place was the chief one. The place next to the host on the right was then, as now, the post of honor." And this incident is elaborated by J. Vernon McGee. I like his Through the Bible commentary. He's a very folksy writer. He gives a lot of down-to-earth illustrations, and I like him for that reason. But he describes this too. He says, this scene is as rich as it can be, the scene of people going in and grabbing the seats of honor. He says, in that day they did not have place cards at the table. Place cards must have been originated by some hostess who wanted to preserve her furniture. Without place cards at the table, there was a mad rush to get to the best seats. At the table in that day, there were four chief places. When the cook said, "Soup's on," everyone made a beeline for the table. And that day, couches rather than chairs were used so that the guests reclined at the table. There were three places to recline on each side. The center place was the seat of honor, which made four chief places. At the head table, there would be seats 1, 2, and 3 on one side. Seat number 2, the center seat, would be the place of honor. Around on the other side would be seats 4, 5, and 6, with number 5 as a seat of honor. Around on the other side are seats 7, 8, and 9, seat number 8, the seat of honor. And on the fourth side of the table, number 11 would be the seat of honor, the four center seats, one on each side of the table. And then he goes on to describe the situation. He says, it is understandable that one of these old Pharisees could not move as fast as some of the younger Pharisees. So when the cook called, "Soup's on," and that phrase isn't in the Bible that I could find, by the way, but the old Pharisee who had moved as close as possible to the dining area ran for seat number two. One of the younger Pharisees got there before he did, so he turned the corner fast and tried to reach number five seat. He was too late again because someone was already sitting there. Quickly he tried for seat number eight, but he did not make it to that seat in time either. He turned the corner and made a dive for seat number 11 and made it. It was the lowest seat, but still a seat of honor. He reclined there out of breath. And still quoting from McGee's commentary, he says, "Can you imagine what a hilarious picture it must have been to see these men running as fast as they could for seats of honor? Now our Lord will correct their manners." Now, has it ever happened to you? I know it's happened to me, not exactly as described there, but have you ever mistakenly sat in the wrong seat somewhere? Maybe at a theater or on a plane or at a sporting event, an arena, any place where you have assigned seating, you accidentally pick the wrong row or the wrong seat number. Or have you ever gotten into the checkout line somewhere thinking you're at the end when actually the line extends around the corner and you're butting in line? Have you ever been humbled when asked to move? No matter how politely people ask, it's still a humbling experience to have someone say, "Oh, excuse me, you're in my seat," or for you to have to go up to someone and say that. Or have you maybe continued sitting at a meal and halfway through realized that you weren't the person that others around you had expected to be there? I've had that happen too, in a kind of a, well, not a real embarrassing situation. It's just that everyone else at the table seemed to know each other well, and I knew a couple of the people, but really didn't belong there. So that happens. Or sometimes, even if you're visiting a different church congregation and you take a seat and partway through get the feeling that you're sitting in someone's favorite seat and they don't ask you to move, but they give you the look. Now, I don't think that happens around here. We don't have assigned seats or anything, but still I know where to look if I'm trying to find someone. And I think we all do. Well, anything like that can be a very awkward experience, and it's a humbling and embarrassing situation. So Christ is just saying that it's better to take the lowest place, and not just a lower place, but the lowest. So let's go on in Luke 14 in verse 10. "But when you are invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that when he who invited you comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, go up higher.' Then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Now notice in the first example, the man who sat in the highest seat of honor, this guest is curtly told to give place to this man. While in the second example, where the person sat in the lowest seat, that guest is warmly and courteously addressed as friend, and he's told to move up to a better seat. Proverbs says something about this too. You can just make a note of Proverbs 25, verses 6 and 7. Proverbs 25, 6 and 7, I'll just read that. "Do not exalt yourself in the presence of the king. Do not stand in the place of the great. For it is better that he say to you, 'Come up here,' than that you should be put lower in the presence of the prince whom your eyes have seen." So the key to this parable about the attitude you should have when going in and taking a seat is humility. And that's the attitude we need to have at the wedding, when we attend the wedding. So that's step three. Step three, which I call how to behave at the wedding. Now, step four, what about at the wedding itself? What could we expect there? So we've been invited. We've been ready. The time has come. We've humbly taken our seat, and we're waiting to see what happens. So let's look what happened at a particular wedding described in John 2, verses 1 through 10. And this is the parable of Christ changing the water into wine. John 2, I'll go through it and just read the parable first. Again, it's a parable that we're all familiar with. John 2, starting in verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast." And they took it. When the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom, and he said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now." So, summary of this is that Christ and his mother and his disciples were at a wedding at which the wine ran out. Christ had the servants fill some water pots with water, and it was miraculously turned into wine, which was immediately served to the master of the wedding. The master of the wedding commended the bridegroom for the high quality of the wine. This is a recording of a miracle that actually happened. Up until now, we've been looking at parables which had been constructed to illustrate a certain point. But this actually happened, so it deserves a little closer look. A question. This was Christ's first miracle, but why this one? Why turning water into wine? Well, something had to be first. Was it just coincidence that this was the first miracle that he did? And depending on how you look at it, it may not seem to be as significant or as necessary as some of his later miracles, like healing or raising from the dead. Was this just like a warm-up to show what he could do? Or I consulted a lot of commentaries to see how they explain these verses. And so let's go through it again in a little more detail. So back to verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And if you look back at preceding chapters, John starts out paragraphs with the next day, again the next day, the following day, and then this one he calls the third day. He's just keeping tracks of what happens on particular days there. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Cana is in Galilee. If you're familiar with a map of Israel, you have the long Dead Sea down on the bottom, the Sea of Galilee, up the round body of water up at the top. Jerusalem was down near the northern tip of the Dead Sea, and Cana is way up here by the Sea of Galilee, just to the west of there. So he wasn't looking for a large crowd or famous people to be present when he did this miracle. He was out among common people. In verse 2, now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. It doesn't say whose wedding it was, and that evidently isn't important to us. The mother of Jesus is never referred to by name in the entire book of John. But Mary, his mother, was there. And multiple commentaries suggest that this may have been the wedding of one of her relatives, because she was there as if she belonged there. and rather than needing an invitation. Jesus and his disciples were also invited. Joseph isn't mentioned, and probably he had died sometime earlier. We don't know much about what happened to him. The bridegroom is mentioned later on, but there's no mention at all of the bride in this incident. Christ honored the marriage ceremony by attending, and it would have been very desirable to have him present at a wedding. And those who wish him to be there must invite him by prayer, and those who followed him were also invited. Then in verse 3, and when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. So again, this is Mary. She said to Jesus that they had no wine. They ran out. There's no mention, no indication of drunkenness or excessive drinking. There may have been more people there than they expected. Maybe because Jesus and the disciples were there, there were others who came who might not have otherwise. Or maybe there was a little more celebration. Or maybe this was just a poor family who couldn't afford enough wine for the number of people who actually showed up. What did Mary mean by her statement when she said to Jesus, they have no wine? What was she saying to him? Well, she saw it as an embarrassment to the family. That would be an embarrassment to run out of food or drink at a wedding banquet. One suggestion is that she could have been hinting that Jesus and his disciples should leave, but I don't think that's the case. But most likely she was asking him to perform a miracle. She was telling him this would be the time to do it. But Jesus said to her, woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. Now, his addressing his mother as woman, no disrespect at all was meant by that. Christ is just reminding her that this is a spiritual matter. If he is to do a miracle, it has to be at the right time. And in spiritual matters, Christ does the will of God the Father, and not the will of any man or even his mother. So his father has to determine when the time is right. But Mary clearly expects him to do something, because she says in verse 5, his mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. She just seems to know that he's going to do something, and it will be something out of the ordinary. Mary doesn't take any offense or argue with Christ, and she just leaves it in his hands. But she clearly expects him to do something. And notice that the servants obeyed Mary, or she expected them to obey her. And that's another indication that she was there as part of the family. Now, verse 6, now there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. These water pots of stone would each hold a total of 120 to 180 gallons, and they were huge pots, and they were very heavy. It's not something you would fill up and plan to move anywhere. In fact, a full water pot, just the liquid in it, would weigh between 165 and 250 pounds, and then the pot itself, I don't know how many hundreds of pounds that would have weighed. Verse 7, Jesus said to them, he said to the servants, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast. And they took it. So he's telling the servants to fill these pots up, to put water in them. And then he's telling them to immediately draw some of that water out and take it to the master of the feast. He doesn't touch the pots, he doesn't touch the water, doesn't touch the wine or anything else that played a part in the miracle. We don't know whether the transformation happened in the pots or in the pouring or while they were carrying it. It doesn't matter. It was clearly a miracle witnessed by Mary and the servants and possibly also the disciples. There were no questions in Christ's mind, though. He knew that this was wine and could be taken immediately to others to drink. and they took it. What were these servants thinking? They saw him pour water in there. Now he's telling them, okay, take some of this water to them and tell them it's wine. You know, they've had so much they won't notice the difference. But no, they if it was water they were taking in, it could have had severe consequences for them. But they could probably tell that it was wine. They seemed to do it without question. Verse 9, when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. The master of the feast, some indicate that it was an honored guest or maybe a person whose duty it was just to govern the ceremony and make sure the guests had enough to eat and drink, but not too much. And surely the servants could tell that he enjoyed it. When the master of the feast called the bridegroom, the servants could tell that he wasn't calling the bridegroom to complain. And indeed he wasn't. In verse 10, he said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now." So this was good wine. This was better than what had been served earlier. Christ is a quality performer. The master of the feast had tasted it, but he hadn't seen where it came from. The servants knew where it came from, but they hadn't tasted it, so their opinions were not tainted. In verse 11, this was the beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. This was the beginning of his miracles. Why did this happen at a wedding, and why this miracle? Well, to honor and bless the ceremony of marriage, but also to foreshadow the great spiritual marriage ceremony that's to come when Christ returns. And what was the miracle? He turned water into wine, of course, but he changed the state of physical matter from something ordinary to something much greater. And he didn't do just the minimum, but he created wine in ample quantity and of high quality. He likewise, at this wedding to come, will change our physical beings into far greater spiritual beings in his kingdom. So that's what's going to happen at the wedding itself. Well, then step 5, what do we need to do now? Let's look at the parable of the expectant steward in Luke 12 and verse 35. "Let your waist be girded and your lamps burning, and you yourselves be like men who wait for their master when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have him sit down to eat and will come and serve them. And if he should come in the second watch or come in the third watch and find them so, blessed are those servants. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." Now, Christ uses another wedding example to warn us that we need to be prepared, to be ready, to be watchful, to be expectant. And in this case, they're waiting for their master who's going to return from a wedding. And you may wonder why they had to be on such high alert day and night. Well, it's because weddings, now when we think of a wedding, we say, well, that'll probably last a couple hours and then there'll be some food. Well, I'll be back around 4 o'clock or 6 o'clock or whatever. But in those days, the wedding would go on and on. It could go on for days. There would be much celebration. People would come and go, and if they ran out of food, they'd bring more food. it was a very joyous celebration. So these servants didn't really know when their master would return. And likewise, we don't know when everything is going to happen. We know we will have signs at the time, and we will know to be ready. And that's what this is telling us. We need to be ready. So in conclusion, now we've looked at a number of parables and examples of weddings, and from that drawn some conclusions about what we need to do to prepare. So the wedding has been planned. The invitations have gone out. We have been invited. Our being here today is a sign that we have accepted the invitation and we're ready for the wedding. The character we're building is the wedding garment that Christ will be looking for. Our humility will lead us to the seat that Christ will have ready for us. And then, as shown by Christ's miracle of changing water to wine at the wedding in Cana, we are going to be changed from this physical body into a spiritual one. And it won't be a halfway job. The wine that he made was of the finest quality. And the spiritual beings that he's going to make will be of the finest quality. And we will be ready for the great wedding ceremony that is to come.